Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. We'll take your calls and your emails. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. And we have a few accumulated emails on a couple of topics.
That's fun. Good.
And we're going to start by, we're close to a very American, maybe the most American holiday, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to discuss American food.
Yes, we are.
Later in the program, we've got some accumulated questions about wine. So
good. All right.
That's something, if you have something that you, that's, you know, sort of wine bugging questions. You want answered, that we can help with that.
Good.
And at the end, we'll see if we can sneak in a chef's challenge.
All right. So what do you think is, what do you think is the significance of American food in our country? How does it impact us as people?
Oh, geez.
I know. Well, you're the philosophical one.
Well, I mean, I would say a couple of different things. I mean, we come from an inequitable world of food privilege compared to the rest of the globe.
We do. That's a good point.
Inequitable within our borders and inequitable compared to a lot of the rest of the world. So I have feelings about that, obviously.
Of course. Sure.
I'm sure you do.
Of course. Well, and it's funny that you brought that up.
So that's, but I don't think it's something you can ever not consider when you're thinking about food.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first thing when someone thinks about food or talks about food is price, right? What is it going to cost? And then the question, like, what percentage of my income goes towards that?
That's a
whole other giant topic.
And what's available to you.
Right.
As well
the
as...
question, and then that has the food distribution system. So you come up with two other excellent program topics. But back to your original question about what is American food, not just what's significant about it, but what is it? I would say that it is it's the world. I mean, we should be the one place where everything sort of melds together in very particular, interesting, dynamic, you know, historically based, product based, tradition based, blended cultures, you know, sort of melting pot situation that allows for things to happen that can't happen other places. I mean, I watch, you have a sous chef from Mexico who did not eat pasta his entire life. He learned to make pasta from watching and learning, from talking with you, from talking with me.
Mm-hmm.
He's very strong at it now.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
It's not part of his background.
Not in any way.
But, I mean.
It's perfect. And he makes some of the best pasta ever.
You know,
it's just amazing. And he loves it. It's just really fun to watch him flourish
He had, you know, one recently with guajillo chilies.
Oh, I know.
The pasta.
Yeah, and exactly.
They gave it a particular smoky flavor. And
It is delicious.
But just thinking, okay, you know what?
That's the beauty of cooking,
well,
is his native influence,
that
influencing
is,
something that's very traditional
in Italy.
I
would say to you, that's American food.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
That's American food.
Absolutely.
You take a tradition from one culture, put it together with the skills and brain of someone from another culture in a new place. You know, that I like that the U.S. is part of what is thought of as the new world.
Mm-hmm, me too. Absolutely.
And the melting pots are different all around the country, which is kind of cool.
Well, and the interesting aspect of that, too, is even in our lifetime, things were more pristine regionally because there wasn't the internet and there weren't mobile telephones and there weren't all these things that tends to really bring us all together. Before, it was so easy to connect through the whole country or even the whole world.
Well, the fluidity of product and information is...
And airplanes.
Not nonstop.
Yeah. The availability of information that is at your fingertips now and the availability of product due to aircraft and shipping and all the way that things have changed has changed what is available to us. And as I said, even in our lifetime, there was, and you grew up here, and I know that there were so many amazing ethnic neighborhoods that were, you know, pretty, you know, solid neighborhoods. You know, I mean, even now, still with the churches, you see the suppers and things where, you know, raviolis or different things are made.
When I grew up, you knew pretty much if someone was Greek, what neighborhood they were from, or if someone was Polish, what neighborhood
they were
from.
And they were making traditional cuisine of there. But those neighborhoods have become much more diverse now, and so things have changed. But I love the fact that there's so much interesting culinary history here in Baltimore from so many different ethnic backgrounds. It's one of the things that I love about this city from the standpoint of living here, as well as being a chef and being able to speak to people and talk to people.
And we typically don't speak about anything politically, but I mean, there, I can't get it out of my head that we have all of this ability to move food. We have all of this development and of technology that helps all of this happen, and we have hungry people in our city.
Oh, it's a terrible thing. That's, yeah, right.
That's that. There are, you know, there are giant food deserts. Anyway, that's a that's a program that we have to get into. The question we would like your help with is, what is American food? What if there is one quintessential American food to you? Just call us and tell us. 410-662-8780. State your case. Foreman Wolf at WIPR.org if you want to email it. But what is the American dish? Is it a hot dog? The other name for a hot dog is Frankfurter.
I think that there are things that people think of as American, you know, like ketchup and hot dogs and hamburgers, but I don't think that that defines in any way American cooking, because we've already said it. There's so many different, you know, influences on the cooking.
We consume a lot more tacos and pizza than we do hot dogs these days.
I prefer to. the thing is that, you know, I was going through some personal notes this morning that I took when my father was still alive. My dad had a terrific memory, and because my dad started off, his father had a butcher shop up in York, and his grandfather also had a butcher shop in the York area. And before that, all my grandfather's family before that were farmers in Hellam, Pennsylvania. And, you know, just talking about, I had asked him about my grandfather was born in 1902, and my mom's father was also born in 1902, which is kind of unbelievable to me that both of my grandfathers on both sides were born the same year, and so were my grandmothers.
Consistency.
Yeah, that's amazing to me. I don't know how that happened, but that's how it was. And my mother's notes talking about, I asked her what it was like when she was growing up. And of course, my mother and father were both alive. They were young people during World War II. And of course, well, my dad went into the war when he was 17. But the rationing thing is fascinating to me, that, you know, what it was like, because we've never had to go through that in our lifetime. And, you know, even from a gas standpoint, which my dad's father, his business relied on a truck to get product through the neighborhoods, because that's how the butcher shop sold their food product, either at market, the real markets, or at through this. Originally, it was a buggy, and then it became a vehicle of some sort. But, you know, the food rationing, you know, my mom was talking about how everybody always had a garden out back, and, you know, the things that they grew, and how she grew up eating so seasonally because that's all that was available to them. And she said, you know, you only went to the grocery store to get things like sugar. Can you imagine that? I mean, that's my mother's lifetime. It's not that long ago. You know, you didn't go to the grocery to buy food. You really, you know, in this area of the country or in that town where my mom and dad grew up. But, you know, they grew everything. So they ate what was in, and that's what root cellars were. Root cellars the cellars back then didn't have heating and air conditioning equipment in it. That's not how they heated their homes. So those root cellars, like my dad talked about, actually digging a hole in the backyard and putting hay over top of it. And that was a root cellar. And my mother talked about the cellar in their home that was completely cold. And that's where all my grandmothers canned, all my grandmothers jarred food. I mean, that was how they lived. And it's such an interesting, that's my American food. That's my American history, which is that my grandmothers both cooked in a Pennsylvania Dutch way and very German influenced cooking. And to me, that is an extremely important part of my family history and has influenced me as a chef and will until I stop cooking. And, you know, those are such important aspects of our cultures. And that's why I love our country, because of all these diversities. What are the influences from your family, Tony?
I mean, it's that there's no end.
Southern ones.
I mean, yeah, I mean, honestly,
of course, I love that. Your grandmother was a great. Your great grandmother was a great cook.
My great grandmother was a great cook. Mm-hmm. My grandmother, like other, other white women of privilege, had a housekeeper who also was a cook. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother was not. I mean, my great-grandmother was born in 1890. She made her own scrapple. Mm-hmm. She was born in North Carolina, and she could do pretty much anything. And she had, you know, it was funny that one of her favorite things to make, I think because it was just easy, and there were three of us that were great grandsons for her, easy to fill up was goulash, which you know is like a proper Hungarian dish, and yeah. You know that. Probably was a new dish to her in the 40s or 50s.
I'm sure it was
coming
exotic.
Right out of, you know, Good Housekeeping exotic. Or something. But that's not the country food she grew up with.
Right.
You know, making pickles and greens and scrapple and frying, you know, fried chicken. Oh
yeah,
my God!
Yeah. I thought you talked about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
did she ever make catfish, or was that something she did not make?
She did not. Yeah. She was from too far inland. That was
okay.
Just not a...
No,
that's
no catfish
that's
available.
That's not a thing where she was.
Sure.
Where she was.
Well, that's
trout,
the thing.
Trout, yes. Catfish, no.
Yeah, that is the interesting thing. I mean, I've always been fascinated, you know, when you study European cooking, and I love progress, but at the same time, I worry about progress sometimes, because that's the other great thing about, you know, if you go to France, if you go to a region, as you well know, you know, you're going to get those traditional dishes. And I just hope those sort of things don't ever get
the same thing's
lost.
Happening in France. I mean, they're...
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's it's just, like I said, it's all about access and information and the ability to share and the ability to, which is, as I said, it's a great thing, but...
I think Italy's probably done a better job than almost any other culture I can think of, at least in the West, that honestly that I know about, as far as preserving food traditions and food ways, food growing ways, mm-hmm. Methodologies. You know, the slow food, I mean, that's an interesting thing for folks to look up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look up the slow food movement, and a lot of the publications are super interesting.
Oh, definitely. Oh, my goodness.
But, I mean, I guess one of the things I was going to say is, I mean, I watch, just in my lifetime, I was witness to my great-grandmother, who was an excellent cook, and honestly kind of a country southern cook,
mm-hmm.
to my grandmother, who was not. I mean, we honestly joked about how poor of a cook she was.
Yeah.
She would try to make something and make it experimentally, and it was she made meatballs once with peanuts in them.
Why did she have all those cookbooks? Your grandmother had literally hundreds of cookbooks.
She loved food and she loved entertaining.
So she would just like go through the books and say, I need you to make this? Is that kind of, I guess that's probably how it worked?
If I wasn't working, I would go to her. I would go and do the food.
That's awesome.
Honestly, when she was older and she couldn't afford to cook, I would go, and she wanted to entertain people, I would go do the food.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's honestly one of the reasons I'm in the business is that
mm-hmm.
you know, that's... It's funny, the first time I ever made pesto, you know, totally fresh, was for a thing at her party,
and her
friends lost their minds.
Oh, my gosh.
And I went and I bought store-bought angel hair pasta,
uh-huh.
Which is not a real shape. And and I made the pesto, and I put it in this huge glass bowl, sort of like a fish bowl. And when I twirled the pasta with the cold pesto... It painted the bowl all these wonderful colors.
Oh, how pretty. Oh, gosh. Gosh, I love that.
And everyone was telling me what a genius I was.
Oh, God.
Like 17 years old.
You're like, oh, boy.
And I was like, that was absolutely an accident. I will absolutely take credit for that.
That's awesome.
Here we go. Here we have Frank, who's been a good contributor.
Yeah.
Let's Frank, so what's American food? What's the dish?
Good afternoon.
Hey, Frank.
I'm going to get to the dish. Can I tell you a quick anecdote about cooking?
Of course.
Yeah, please.
First, I'm so happy that, you know, we have embraced the kitchen. You see so many people learning to cook, trying to cook, wanting to cook.
Uh-huh.
When my daughter was a freshman in college, we moved her up and we went to an old friend of mine, a woman I had dated in college. Now she was married. She had friends. And we all went there for a big dinner. And this woman had this huge, beautiful gourmet kitchen, Vulcan 8-burner gas range with twin ovens and this and the other, and she swore she couldn't cook. And I could never understand that. And so my ex-wife and I rolled up our sleeves and put together this wonderful meal, and I noticed that she hadn't bothered looking over our shoulder or asking any questions, and I couldn't figure that out. And then we got to the table, and she took one bite, and she just, oh, this is so, I can't believe this came out of my kitchen. And there was my answer. She didn't want to give up the magic that occurs when you take that first bite by, as to use an expression, seeing how the sausage was made. that she was afraid that she'd never be able to do that, so she'd leave it to somebody else. Well,
wow.
Since then, she has embraced it. And I would tell everyone, you know, take a look. If you can read, you can cook. If you can observe and ask questions, you can cook. And just take a shot at it. And the magic will remain, except now you can hold claim to it.
Exactly.
Well, as you explore food and food cultures, I mean, there's always going to be more new magic for you to check out.
Yeah, absolutely. The all-American dish for me is meatloaf.
Mm-hmm.
I love meatloaf, and whenever I cooked my meatloaf, I would I would put it on a Brilla grate in the oven. Some people put it in a loaf pan. I don't do that. And I would drape bacon over the top.
That's
and
good.
And then after the bacon was done, I'd take it off. And as it was finishing, then, yes, I would drizzle the top with ketchup and let it finish. And it
that's definitely an
wonderful
all-American technique right there, Frank.
Yeah, yeah. Bacon and then ketchup. There you go.
Good go. Well, always enjoy listening to you guys. And
thank you, Frank.
Have a happy summer.
Thanks,
Frank.
You too.
You too.
That's nice.
So give us a ring if you like. Tell us what your quintessential American food is. 410-662-8780. We've got some emails to get to, and you can email us also, foremanwolf@wipr.org. And we'll be right back on Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
We're live today. We're taking your calls. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. I've got an email here that just came to us. Charlie in Charles Village. So a neighbor. I just wanted to share a tradition we've been doing to celebrate the 4th of July the past few years. You have to eat hot dogs and hamburgers and watermelon. But we ask people to bring a dish that celebrates fusion food, for lack of a better word.
That's fun.
Tex-Mex, Chinese-American food, Native American dishes. It's always fun to see what people come up with. It's never an Independence Day party without Mexican seven-layer dip.
Yes. That's fun. I like that idea. Smart.
And here's a quick question for you, Cindy, from a listener. From a listener named Cindy.
Oh.
I love the show. Listen when I can. Several times you folks have suggested making a soup from unused asparagus parts.
Mm-hmm.
The stems.
Mm-hmm.
I think of the parts you mean, Cindy. I know not to use the white parts, but what do I do to make a soup with the parts that don't make the snap?
Yeah.
I've saved those unused parts, and now I need to make either a soup or discard them to make room in my freezer.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't have frozen them. To start with, I don't know what's going to happen when you cook frozen asparagus. It might be okay. I don't know. So I would suggest making the soup when you have the fresh asparagus. But since that's not what's happening, do clean off those ends. Discard them because they're going to have sand in them. So what the good part that's left, saute onions and shallots and butter. You know, let's say you're making soup for six people. One onion, maybe four shallots of good size. Small dice, saute it gently in butter. Do not get any color on them, but you do want them to sweat and become tender. And you can either add cream, salt and pepper, and bring that up to a boil and let it simmer for about 10-15 minutes. Or you could add chicken stock and cream, 50-50. You could add just, I think those are the choices. And bring that up, let it simmer. So what happens is that what I call a soup base allows the onion and shallot to flavor it. The seasoning happens, and then add the asparagus at the end. Now, with the ends, you're not going to have a lot of color anyway, so you can kind of cook them to death, which will get you the most flavor, extract the most flavor from the asparagus. If you are concerned about the color, you want a little color, you could, when you go to puree the soup, you could add a little bit of fresh spinach, which will not really flavor it too much. But even just a few, like a cup or so of fresh spinach will give you some pretty color. If you want to avoid that and be pristine and only taste like asparagus, then puree and strain, and you're going to have a tremendous amount of fibrous material because the ends are really fibrous.
So straining is a big
deal. Takes,
you've
got to strain it a couple of times. You want to go through a chinois, which is one of the finest sieves that there is, and you know, or just get a good sieve. It doesn't have to be a chinois, but get a really fine sieve and pass it through a couple of times, and sort of push it through with a ladle or with a spatula, plastic spatula, something to try and extract as much as you can, and then pass it again. And just check it for seasoning, and that's it. So I hope, I'm curious, Cindy, if you would let me know how it goes with the frozen, because I'd like to hear the answer to that. So let us know if you feel like telling me. Thank you.
Let's take a call from Neil in Windsor Hills. Hey, Neil, how are you?
Hi, Neil.
Hey, how are y'all?
Good, how are you? Oh, y'all.
Okay, I just feel like bragging on my state. Look, it comes down to corn and tomatoes in season and steamed crabs, and there is nothing more quintessentially American.
I'm sorry. Is this,
Baltimore boy.
Is this my brother undercover?
Now, can I brag for just a second?
Yes.
One of your chefs is my farmer's market neighbor, and he and his wife are amazing bakers. And I'm not going to drop names, but I just hope you'll give him a little wink the next time you see him, because you know perfectly well who I'm talking about.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, I'm excited about your tomatoes, corn, and steamed crabs. That sounds good right now, and it's the perfect time of year for it all. Thank you.
Yeah, everything's just coming now. Thanks, Neil. We had a call with a comment, but not on the line. Daniel, we eat real American food with our hands: sandwiches, fried chicken,
fresh fruit.
I would say the whole world eats with their hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the French ate with their hands, and then even a spoon until, the Italian queen, Catherine de' Medici, showed up and civilized and brought proper cooks to France from Florence.
I like that, though. I love that.
And forks.
We eat real American food with our hands.
But the world eats with their hands. I mean, is the bread in Ethiopia? I mean, injera is the bread, right? So you get a platter with all kinds of
Ethiopian food.
Yeah, with all kinds of. There's the spicy kale business. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I apologize that I don't know all the names. I mean, I wish I was an expert on Ethiopian food, but I'm certainly not.
Mm-hmm.
But that's very fun. You basically take something that's very much like a tortilla, you know, and you grab whatever there and make little quickie mini sandwiches as you go.
Yeah, I love that. That's a fun way to eat.
We've got more emails here. We've got Edith in Millersville. I think the definition of American food is its inability to be defined.
Hmm.
Like you said in the intro of your show, it is a tapestry.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
That's much more elegantly said than I did.
Yeah, that's really beautifully put.
We each have our own heritages, traditions, and a personal story of what American food means to us. The beauty is in our ability to gather at the table and share those food stories with each other. We're at a moment in our culture where we're not all gathering at the table too much.
And we need to gather at the table. That is one of the reasons why I like being a chef, is knowing that the people in the dining room are coming together to be together, hopefully to enjoy each other's company, to get to know each other better, to share time together around the table. I think that is just one of the most important things.
One of the nice things about being in the restaurant business is you see people seeing folks they don't always see.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
That habit, the common thread of they want to come and eat your cooking, or or they want to partake of a particular environment, or you know what I mean. That's you see five anniversaries going on in the dining room at one time, and you have all different ages and
definitely
races and orientations, and that's a cool thing, a universal thing, and I don't know that every guest thinks about it, but I know that it's positive for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then Edith continues, maybe it's less of a dish, but an activity. There is nothing more American than a barbecue on a weekend, like so many of us just had over the 4th. I would say we're good at barbecue, and there's a lot of different barbecue in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole lot of, in the Spanish-speaking world, there's a whole lot of asado.
I was just going to say this. The
Argentines might have us trumped pretty gigantically.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no pun intended.
But we know how to barbecue, Tony. We know how to barbecue. But yeah, there's so many other cultures the whole kebab thing on the grill, the asado, as you say. I mean, I will never forget the first time I experienced asado with my chef, Marcelo Vasquez from when I worked for him in Charleston when I was very young. And I mean, just having that experience of, I still can't imagine where he came up with that gigantic piece of grill top that he worked on, but it was only probably about a foot or so off the ground with a huge fire going underneath it.
And big hunks of
metal. It was huge. Yeah, it was just, it was bigger than this room that we're in. And to see him out there, you know, just working.
That's
like,
how you put big pieces of animal on it.
Oh my gosh. Well, yeah, we did, he would do a whole pig and we would do 5 gallons of chimichurri.
And I mean, all the
veggies.
That
takes a while to make, yeah. Let me tell you. We would make the chimichurri the day before and he would put almost all of that chimichurri in the cavity of the hog. And oh my gosh, I mean, it was one of the best things in the world. But I grew up in part of my life in North Carolina, and you know, barbecue is just a serious thing in this country. I mean, you know, and it's another aspect of regional cooking is that, you know, each region in the South has its own version of what they like to make for barbecue. And I think that's another just fascinating thing to study in American culture from a food standpoint is, you know, what were the original influences on that cooking that made them decide to do, you know, a tomato-based barbecue or a vinegar-based barbecue or whatever. But barbecue is super important.
Or a dry rub barbecue like in Texas where it's dry and dusty and
yum. Mm-hmm. Gosh, yum yum.
The
We were talking about Frank was talking about the
meatloaf.
Meatloaf, thank you. And I love ground meat. Okay,
I
hate meatloaf. Okay, but I don't like the meatloaf my mother made. I'm sorry, Mom.
Hate is not a nice word.
I'm sorry. I know. And but I
my
dislike.
My 5-year-old would be all over you about
right,
that.
Okay, well it's a good thing she's not here. So the idea. First of all, I disgust. Raw onions disgust me.
Wow. You know, my other
understand.
Idea for a topic today was, what's all the food that you really don't like? What's all the
I
food
can't
that you hate?
And raw onions and meatloaf, because it never really quite changes the onion enough. And then you have these like weirdly sort of warm.
Well, you made a
odd,
different version of meatloaf
yesterday.
Never fully
cooked. That's the thing. I told you, I love ground meat. And it's just so much fun to work with ground meat. And there's so many better ways to make ground meat than it is to do the, I'm sorry, everybody's going to get mad at me, but the traditional American meatloaf, that's my thought. I like chili powder with ground meat. It could be pork. It could be ground lamb. It could be ground beef, but I like chili powder or go the sumac way with a little saffron. I know that's expensive. You're going to yell at me. Or cumin, cayenne, you know, sort of all those earthy spices or curries. I mean, there's so many other ways to flavor ground meat, and it is an excellent way to feed a large family. Ground meat is inexpensive, and as long as it's good quality ground meat without too much fat in it. You want some fat because fat is moisture, fat is flavor. But, you know, if you get really ground meat is a great way to feed people. So
I mean, it comes from the tradition
it's a lot
of
fun ways
of
to cook
people
it.
Preserving, you know, that it's a type of charcuterie. It's just we don't realize it, but pretty much anything that you're doing
like
it's utilizing terrine, all parts
terrine,
of the animal.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing begins as a terrine. I mean, you made a galantine.
No, that's what you're referring to.
Yesterday.
I made a galantine of guinea fowl and foie gras with a little and I
so
use lamb
meatloaf.
Scraps. I use the chains from the lamb tenderloins. Yeah. Well, that's why I say I work with ground meat all the time. I just not super, super thrilled by the whole.
You know, but I mean, empanadas are another version of
empanadas.
Empanadas
oh
with
gosh.
Any kind of meat or another,
another
version of charcuterie.
Fantastic way to feed a bunch of people that is
salami,
inexpensive.
Salami and all of the Italian salumi is another version of, you know, prosciutto is another kind of charcuterie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So. That's
cool.
Anyway, let's take a quick call from George in Towson. George, how are you?
Hi, George.
I am well. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Of course.
My wife and I are headed to Savannah, so you're talking about American food. So I'm wondering, we've been there a couple times, but we have not been able to crack the code of, we've been to a couple places that I think came recommended, but we weren't that crazy about. And I think complicating things is we are vegetarians. Now, I eat seafood. My wife does not. So that's kind of a tough one for you guys. But I don't know how well you know the Savannah cuisine.
I would say, in general, if you're rolling pork-free, you may want to change that vacation to California or something.
Okay.
Because if you're going down south, that's a big piece of it. I mean,
it's
the first thing that comes to my mind is
cooking.
Is Wall's Barbecue, if it still exists. I'm not sure that it does, but that was fantastic.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, I've now lived in Baltimore for 25 years, and I've spent very little time down in Savannah since I moved here. So I can't give you a recommendation, but, you know, I mean, there's certainly plenty of farms in the Savannah area, so I'm sure, and the chefs are, you know, you know, probably cooking like most of the people in the country with a lot more vegetables than we used to, but I can't give you a direct recommendation for Savannah.
But sure. I'm wondering if you guys would like to hear about the restaurant I miss the most.
Yes, of course.
Sure.
Would love to.
Do you guys remember Angelina's on Hartford Road?
Of course, yeah. That ridiculous crab cake. Yeah.
It had, yeah, the crab cakes. It had what they called a shebeen in the basement, which was an Irish pub where you got Guinness Stout. And then you would get those softball-sized crab cakes.
Oh, yeah. I went there as a kid.
I use pickles and mustard on my crab cakes.
Yum.
And their crab soup was just fantastic, and it was a very intimate, down-homey place. I really miss it a lot.
When did it close? It's been probably
10 years.
I think at least 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I never went there.
My youngest brother, I used to torment him. I think I was probably 11 or 12, so he's 5 years younger than me, and he's our CFO now. I used to torment him by they were pickled hot peppers, like cherry bomb peppers. And Angelina's.
Did you eat crab cakes with those?
No, they would be on the table, and we'd be the kids, and we'd be bored, waiting for food to come, and I would offer him like a nickel if he would eat a chili pepper, and he would suffer for like 25 minutes afterwards. But he wanted that nickel. I was a terrible brother. I apologize.
George.
He's still speaking with you.
That's yeah.
He still works with me every day.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. George, there is a restaurant in Savannah that we went to before we opened.
It's been there a very long
time. Yeah, it's called Ms. Wilkes' Dining Room or Boarding House.
I've heard of that.
Now,
yeah.
I don't know if it's still open, so do some research. If it is still open, I mean, you might want to go there. It's really such a traditional and fun introduction into the cooking of that region.
The big tables and people pass bowls around.
Exactly right. And you take your dishes back to the kitchen.
You take your own dishes back to the dish station. Love that part.
You have two choices for a beverage. You can have sweet iced tea or you can have sweet iced tea.
Yeah. And I honestly have never seen Tony eat as much food ever anywhere as he did. And our sous chef at the time. Oh, my God. And Peter Keck.
Our sous chef time was about 120 pounds bigger than me.
Oh, my gosh. I've never seen people eat so much food in all of my life. So, I mean, it might be fun to go there.
That sounds like fun. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, George.
Take care. Bye.
Let's see. Here we are from Devin. To me, a tomato sandwich is quintessential American food. There's nothing better than a fresh sliced tomato with a touch of salt on two slices of good bread.
I love that.
Devin, you're easy to please.
Yeah, I like that.
I guess
that.
I'm hoping that you're fussy about your tomatoes.
I love a tomato sandwich.
Let's go ahead and take the call from Joshua and Arnold.
Hi, Joshua.
Go ahead.
Hey there. I'm so glad you guys took my call.
Of course.
Yeah. I just want to say that I've been listening to you guys for several years. And in fact, when I was working down in Easton and living in Chestertown, Maryland, I would be working on Sunday and driving back home around the time your show was on, and you guys would always inspire me so much to come home to my kitchen and try to make something after my drive.
That's
lunch.
Cool.
So
really nice. Thank you.
Thanks for all the inspiration.
Appreciate your kind words. Yeah, and I love Chestertown.
That's cool.
Yeah,
thank
it's a very
Joshua.
Beautiful place. But I'm here in Arnold, Maryland now, but I just wanted to comment and tell you a story that happened to me when I was in high school in around 2008 or 2009. I was taking a Spanish class, and our teacher at the time we were going over, the food subjects and learning the difference between a taco and a burrito. But she proposed the question to the class, what do you think is served in an American restaurant in other countries? Because we have, French restaurants and Italian restaurants and, Mexican restaurants, too. And we kind of have a general sense of what food is served, but she proposed to us the question of, what food is served in an American restaurant. And we were all trying to guess, and it was similar, to this conversation you guys are having now. But she said, and I don't know how true this is, but she was definitely more traveled than me, and I was an impressionable, 15-year-old.
Clearly.
And she said that what was served is barbecue, along with jazz music playing in the background. And so I guess that's my answer to your question of what's American food.
There you go.
That's okay.
Yeah.
If our exports are barbecue and jazz music.
Yeah, that's good.
I can live with that.
Yeah, and you're just talking about how, you know, maybe Argentina does it better, but
it's a different thing.
Pretty darn good there too.
Yeah. Definitely. We do a good job with our barbecue.
Thanks Joshua.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thanks so much for listening and having the show.
You're very nice. Thank you so much.
So when we come back, you can still reach us, 410-662-8780. Tell us what is the quintessential American food, or send us an email, formerwolf@wipr.org. We've got a couple of emails accumulated with questions about wine. If you have wine questions, this is a good time to slip it in there so we can try to get it here in the last segment. And we will be back in just a few moments on Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. You can get us 410-662-8780. We want to know what you think is the quintessential American food. We've had some interesting thoughts. Some meatloaf and barbecue tossed in there. Mm-hmm. Or send us an email, foremanwolf@wipr.org. And let's take a quick call from... Can we take Marshall? Marshall, why don't you go ahead?
Yes. Hi, Marshall.
Hi. I called a few months back. I was the person who didn't like eggs but wanted to know how to cook them.
Okay, yes, I remember.
Well,
do you like them now?
And the most successful way that I've been able to incorporate this so far is with shakshuka.
I don't know what that is.
Tell us what you make.
It's a Middle Eastern stewed tomato and egg dish.
Yum.
So
okay, good.
Cook the tomatoes low and slow with different Mediterranean spices. I've really liked using za'atar.
Oh, za'atar can be fun.
And then add the eggs in, and you can kind of mix everything around. And it's been the most successful way that I've been able to try to appreciate eggs more.
Do you scramble eggs before you put them in, or you put them in as whole eggs?
They basically poach in the tomato stew.
Love it. That sounds so good. Good job.
That's great.
Cool. Thanks for the update, Marshall.
I really appreciate the advice, and it's been a good way to prepare eggs for my wife in a way that I can also enjoy them.
That's awesome. Thank you. That's great, Marshall.
Thanks, Marshall.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much.
I love eggs. I can't help it.
Oh, my God. You know, the first person I ever heard say that?
I just have to say that. I love them.
The old heavyweight champ, Larry Holmes.
He loves eggs? Loved eggs? Is he still alive?
Very, very famous long interview
Larry Holmes. I like
about how eggs were what powered him to the championship.
Oh, that's cool. Do you remember how people used to eat? This is a little off topic. Didn't fighters used to eat raw eggs? Now that I can't do.
Well, they famously showed Sylvester Stallone on the movie.
Is that what it was? Okay, that's what's coming
eggs,
back to my mind. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a nut for like my kids. Like I want them to eat an egg every day, and I want them to drink a cup of milk every day.
Oh.
I'm twitchy about it.
Sure. Uh huh.
So
how's that going?
You know, with Dell, it's always been pretty good because she colors inside the lines. With Odalette, she'll just.
Nope.
I love her very much.
Okay. So you had a wine question, Tony?
We have a couple of listeners' wine questions we can get into.
Okie dokie. Let's talk wine.
You can call about that if you would like. And this is from Barbara. Barbara says, a friend and I usually drink less expensive wine. For an occasion, we got some more expensive bottles, wondering if we could taste the difference. We got a Louis Jetto 15, 2015 vintage, Pinot Noir, Bourgogne, Rayburn, Russian River Valley, Pinot Noir 2016, and Left Coast 2016 Estate Pinot Noir Cali's Cuvée Willamette Valley, Oregon.
Willamette Valley.
Not only were they different from the Lees Fitch that I usually drink, but they were totally different from one another. Not only were the wines different from one another, but so were our individual tastes. My friend's favorite, the Louis Jetto, was my least favorite. I prefer the Left Coast. Same grape. Why were they so different? Hmm. We didn't taste the wine with food, but it would have seemed to go with different things. What would you pair with them and why? I don't understand pairing at all.
Good. Good question. Excellent question. I love that.
So thanks so much for sharing, Barbara. This is, it begs an interesting question. I can fill in some blanks for you a little bit. Those vintages on those wines are pretty important. They're all younger. In Burgundy in particular, that's the northernmost region that you usually see Pinot Noir grown. And 15 was a warmer, riper year. That being said, they're well north. I mean, think about growing something in Montreal versus growing it in California or in Oregon. It's it's well north. So much later bud break. It takes much longer to ripen and grow. You have the very long days in the middle of the summer, right? Mm-hmm. You have usually cooler nights through a lot of the growing season. That's probably why that wine, you noticed it was probably a little more tart than the two West Coast wines, which are going to show more alcohol in general. That alcohol is also something that comes off as sweet on the palate.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So if you drop the acidity and your alcohol is higher, it's going to... They're very, very ripe red wines that have a lot of alcohol can almost have like a chocolatey or a jammy character, right? Mm-hmm. You rarely find that kind of thing with Pinot Noir from Burgundy. I would also say that the 15 Bourgogne Pinot Noir is a good example of Pinot Noir from Burgundy, but it is still a pretty modest example. The reason that Burgundy is famous is because of the stuff that's largely crazy expensive and a few gems sort of along the way in between. And those are wines that almost always improve with some age in the cellar. They become more delineated, detailed. It's sort of like listening to a three-piece band as a young wine and then hearing the same song with a 15-piece big band. It's a different experience. You get many more notes. It's kind of.
You mean as it ages?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. You can tell a better story when you're 50 something, sure, than you can when you're 20 something.
Usually. Got it.
Although you're probably more excited about it when you're 20 something. So, wine with food. I mean, I would bet that if you had anything to eat, that you would have liked the Jetto a lot more than you did on its own.
It makes such a difference.
It makes a giant difference.
Yeah.
It
wine needs food, and food needs wine sometimes.
It's very hard for me to have wine without food.
I agree.
It needs a job to do. Mm-hmm. If you want something for your porch just as a refreshment, you know, then or just kind of hanging around, then aperitif, something like that. You want something light, clean, fresh, you know, showing off its fruit, absolutely. But something that actually has more structure, alcohol, tannin, acidity, that's to clean up fat on your palate and to balance with the intensity of flavors and the types of flavors that are part of the dish.
Do you have any specifically for the Burgundy? The Burgundy was, the bone was red or white? It was red.
Red. Pinot Noir.
So something like duck or is it too young for that?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. I mean,
some sort of beef or.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly.
Maybe
that's
beef.
Beef, but not a
with
heavy,
mushrooms.
Not a heavy preparation.
Beef and mushrooms and.
Well, you have more earthy flavors usually.
Onion marmalade, something like that.
Mm. Yeah, you start throwing in onion marmalade, and maybe you want that for the Oregon.
Okay. Because there's a little vinegar in there.
Well, the.
Or the sweetness of the onion.
It's also the weight is going to be greater, and the sweetness of the onion is going to do better with the wine that has the riper fruit, if that makes sense. So we have another question here. This is from our friend Willis in Waverly. Long-time listener, love the show. I'm not much for aging wines. I've had some older wines, and I understand the difference in flavor. I just don't care for secondary flavors. That's very judgy of you, Willis. I'm wondering, though, how long I can keep a wine I intend to drink relatively soon, how long after I open the bottle.
So those are
different questions. Mm-hmm. The large majority of wine is produced to be consumed very soon after its production. You know, that's if it's released, largely you would consume it. People sometimes ask about screw-top wines. Mm-hmm. Is it okay? Does that mean it's not as nice? No, it means they want you to drink it sometime soon. A cork is better for long-term aging and is more consistent for long-term aging because of the exchange of oxygen with the cork. If it's nylon or if it's totally sealed, like a screw top, there's no exchange. It doesn't go through. It's not packaged for the aging process, let's say.
So it needs oxygen to age.
So Willis 1, I'm telling you, if you don't want to drink anything older, buy screw tops. And you won't have any flawed wines that are damaged by their corks.
There you go.
And I think most people, it's funny, I'll often talk about the epiphany wine that someone has. I've been privileged to be part of many, many people's first experience with something that really just changed how they think about wine, how they experience it. And they engage with it somehow centrally differently from how they have before.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's because of some olfactory note or if that's because of it being with a particular dish or being somehow totally unexpected, much more, you know, they actually connect with it in a very particular way. And it's funny that I think that's probably what Willis needs. Because there are marvelous wines, and I love to drink wines that are young and that, like, full of bursting fruit and juicy, and they dominate some dishes, for sure. And sometimes the wines, as they age, they get incredibly interesting. But 95% of wines are not meant to be consumed more than 2-3 years after they're produced.
Hmm. So. All right. It's the whole American food thing is such an honor to be a part of. I mean, getting back to the original thought process of the show, I mean, for me, having the opportunity to do a lot of research on particularly low country cuisine of South Carolina and realize what the incredible influences are on that cooking and how important, you know, the West African culture is on that food.
You learn all about one particular melting pot that's totally different from what your family's background is.
Yeah, very different.
And that's, you know, you're doing exactly what your sous chef did,
mm-hmm.
you know, the fellow from Mexico originally who was making pasta, really sophisticated, beautiful pasta
mm-hmm.
in a new way.
Yeah, it's a privilege to.
We have one more comment from a caller who's not on the line, Bobby. The most American food, Taco Bell's Doritos Nacho Cheese Chalupa. Why? Branding. Branding is definitely amazing power in our culture and also maybe sometimes. I would like to talk to you, Bobby, because I'd like to know if you're joking or not. So quick. All-time best American food.
Oh, God.
Your favorite, number
one. Oh, my
one,
God.
Top
of
the list.
I don't know.
Come on.
Oh, my God. Don't do that
Spit
to me.
Spit it out.
Okay. American food?
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say something my mother made, which was now you're freaking me out.
Don't say SpaghettiOs.
God. I was going to say, no.
I'm afraid we're out of time,
Cindy. Are you
kidding me? We're out of time. So.
Thanks, Tony.
Sorry. Yeah, thanks for,
thanks
thanks
a
for
lot,
being
Tony.
Ready for the question.
Thanks for doing that to me.
Thanks for being ready for the question.
That was like a weird chef's challenge.
No, not at all. That was just challenging the chef.
Sauerkraut
it's not a
chef's
challenge.
And pork. My answer is sauerkraut and pork made by my grandmother.
Okay.
There you go.
If you want to listen to this episode, again, because it's been fascinating, or any one of the other fine programs that WIPR has produced for us, go to the WIPR website and look up the podcast for Foreman and Wolf, and there's a full menu there. If you want to email us, it's foremanwolf@wipr.org. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media.
On Twitter is Chef Cindy Wolf. On Instagram is Chef Wolf.
My infrequent Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman.
And that's that.
And that is that. All and right. And go, U.S. ladies.
Oh, yes.
Gosh, I hope
go
you won in the
US
World Cup.
Go, U.S. ladies. Oh, that's so exciting.
Bye-bye.